The hot pots tasted beautiful. Oh, steam coming from them, and then Christmas pudding. What a feast. The hall used to be packed. Then when everyone had finished, and as I say, the policemen and their wives used to serve this up with big smiling faces and heaping on, and you could have seconds if you wanted. But when it was all finished, you all got up and then you all marched off down to the picture house in Strand Street. And there they put on a good show of children's films. The place was full of shouting out and laughter. And then when the film show had finished, as you came out, the policemen were waiting for you as you came out, and they gave us a bag each. An apple and orange in and some sweets, and I think there was a balloon or something, quite a good bag full of goodies to eat. Oh, it was looked forward to all year long, was the policeman's hot pot. I bet there are still quite a lot of folk alive in Douglas today who remember those hot pots. The memories of youth, it's marvellous. I've been going on about the memories of youth. I think I should mention about my family, or introduce you to my family. Now, my father, he wasn't a tall man by any means, about 5 foot five, 5 foot six. But he'd had a good education. When they lived in Wolverhampton, he was a choir boy at Wolverhampton Cathedral, and he boarded in there and was educated at the cathedral with the other choir boys. Then when they moved to the Isle of Man, he went to the local grammar school in Douglas, which was only a small building in Dalton Street, and it ceased to be a school long before I was born, probably before the First World War, I would imagine, because it was a very small building, so there couldn't have been many pupils there. But that is where he was educated, at the Douglas Grammar School. And then when his education was finished, his father wanted him to go into the bank. My father, he wasn't too keen on that. He wanted to go to sea, so his father sent him off to sea. And he set off to sea under sail, in a sailing ship, and he sailed round Cape Horn, seen some bad weather. I know he told me about it when I was young. And he says, used to make me laugh the way he said then, in those days they had wooden ships and iron men. Nowadays they've got iron ships and wooden men. And also he liked to tell me, or ask me, a question which he used to ask many grown-up men: how many ropes are there on a fully rigged ship? And he used to catch many people out with this question: how many ropes are there in a fully rigged ship? When they couldn't answer him, he used to tell them, there are only three: the tow rope, the bell rope, and the bucket rope. All the rest are runners and halyards. So that's how many ropes there are on a fully rigged sailing ship. Only three. And then when World War One came along, he joined up at the start, and he served in the Royal Army Service Corps. All his service was in France, and he was in quite a few of the big battles: Mons and Verdun, Passchendaele. And he was gassed in one of the gas attacks, and for the rest of his life, his eyes had they looked red. His eyes always had that pinkish tint. and he wore glasses. He never got a pension. He never received any pension for it. And for a while he was stationed at Earl Haig's headquarters. That's why when I was born, he called me Douglas. My middle name is Douglas, Arthur Douglas Adams. And that's how I come to get my name Douglas, because he had served at Haig's headquarters. And at the end of the war, he finished up as a staff sergeant, so he must have. Had some go in him. And then when he worked at the steam packet as a docker, he saved quite a few people, I believe, from drowning in the surrounds of the harbour. One in particular, he saved the life of a man named Corkish on the 10th of February in 1909. And he received a parchment scroll from the Royal Humane Society, and also he received a certificate from the Liverpool Weekly Post. I have it in front of me at the moment. It's the Liverpool Weekly Post Merit Award. This is to certify that Charlie Adams has been adjudged by the editor of the Liverpool Weekly Post worthy of and has been presented with one of the silver merit medals given by that newspaper to persons who have performed what are considered the most meritorious deeds of the week in any walk of life, dated the 20th of February 1909. Oh, he was a marvellous swimmer. There was an open air swimming pool on Douglas Head, just at the foot of Douglas Head, behind the what was called the breakwater, just below Douglas Head Lighthouse, where the lighthouse is in Douglas Head. It was called Port Skillion, and it was done away with many, many years ago. Just after the war, the Second World War, I think. But every Sunday morning in the summer, he used to go up there and swim, and he used to tag me along. I was his favourite, being the smallest, youngest, and I used to have to sit and watch him swim. And it used to be packed with people, that swimming pool, and sitting around on the rocks all round it. And he was a bit of a show-off. He used to do high dives, and then he used to swim underwater and lie on the bottom for ages and ages until people used to get worried that he was drowned. He was lying on the bottom of the pool. I used to get worried until I realised that he could do it, and then eventually when people started to get worried, he used to come to the surface. Oh, he was quite a bit of a showman. But he was strict with discipline in the family. He was just as if he was in the army, and he was still the sergeant. All shoes and boots had to be polished the night before. Before you went to bed, your shoes and boots had to be polished. Not just me, but my brother and my sisters. And everything had to be, as he used to say, there's a place for everything, and everything should be in its place. And when my mother used to do his washing, his laundry, she was never allowed to put his underwear or ties or any clothes of his away in his drawer. Only he was allowed to go in that drawer, and he used to pack. It was all laid out, regimental. As he said, he could wake up in the night with no light and go and put his hands in the drawer and pick out what he wanted. Everything was laid out meticulously. And he was a very natty dresser. He used to always dress himself smart. And in the summertime, he always wore a flower in his the lapel of his jacket. And if he went out in the evening, he used to wear a Trilby hat. And to go to work, he had a workman's cap, a flat cap. And he smoked quite heavy. I always remember it. There was a brand of cigarettes came out in the mid-30s, somewhere around 32 or 33, called Club, C-L-U-B. A very, very cheap cigarette. They were like the Woodbines, which you could buy at that time, 5 for 2p. I always remember that they had an offer on. If you saved 28 of these packets, 28 of these empty packets, and sent them off, they would send you a cloth, flat, working man's cap. And he swore all the time he smoked these cigarettes. He was coughing. My mother was saying, and my brother and the rest of the family, why don't you stop smoking? And you'll cough yourself to death. And he said, I don't care if I kill myself. I'm going to get that cap. And he saved up, and he smoked those cigarettes until he got the 28. Packets, empty packets, and he sent it off for a, I always remember it was like a black and white check cap, which he wore at work. But when he smoked, he always used a cigarette holder. He wouldn't put a cigarette into his mouth unless it was in a holder. And there were short holders, about 4 inches in length. And the family bought them for him for Christmas presents. And they had to be white. They had to be white. And as he smoked with them, gradually the nicotine stained the white and they became first a faint light tan and gradually they grew darker. When they got to a certain darkness, he threw that away and had a new one. That's why they had to be white. Probably he guessed that it was too much nicotine. We'll always remember that, but he's very meticulous and regimental. And I always remember too, on a Sunday morning, he cooked the breakfast. My mother could lie in bed. The family, they used to go to work then at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. My mother always cooked the breakfast. But on a Sunday morning, my father cooked it. And it was breakfast at 9 o'clock. He would come to the door and he would shout, "Wakey, wakey, rise and shine. The sun is scorching your eyes out. No matter whether it could be pouring rain outside." But that was it every Sunday morning. "The sun is scorching your eyes out. Rise and shine. Breakfast is on the table." Now then, you had to be there at the table at 9 o'clock. And my brother, of course, he was in his teens then. He was going out to dances and enjoying himself. Probably having a drink, I suppose. He'd be late for breakfast on a Sunday morning. My father would wait 5 minutes, and then he would put the egg on my plate and a bit of bacon on Connie's plate, and another bit of bacon on his plate. And my brother, if he come in at 9:10, the breakfast had gone. My father used to say, "You know, breakfast is 9 o'clock. If you can't be here for your breakfast at 9 o'clock, well, it's too bad." That's how he was. And then when we moved to Hillside Avenue, oh, it was wonderful to have a house, to move into a house with a garden. We had a little tiny garden at the back, and at the rear was a fair-sized garden. Now, he'd never done any gardening in his life, but he said to him, we all had to help him dig, and the garden sloped down at the back, so he made a couple of beds at the rear alongside the house, the level of the house, and 3 or 4 steps down onto the next staging. And then he made a path left and then right down to the bottom, and it was all regimental. All his potatoes were in straight rows. Cabbages were in another straight row, peas in another straight row, and the 2 top beds by the steps, they had flowers. and over the steps he built an arch and had rambling roses over it. He made quite a good job of the garden, but as if everything was regimental. He was a funny old chap and he liked a drink. My sister said he was a drunk, my eldest sister, but I can honestly say I never, ever saw him drunk. I've seen him a bit merry, but never drunk. But I still disbelieve what my sister used to say, because on the money he was receiving then as a dock labourer, it was only a pittance. The men were only paid for what actual work they'd done. In the summertime, the ships were regular, but into the wintertime, the bad weather and gales, they were lucky sometimes to get one small boat in a week, and so they were only paid the few hours for discharging that one boat. And there was no dole or unemployment pay in the Isle of Man. There was unemployment pay, which was called the dole then, in those days, in the UK, but not in the Isle of Man. That was my father. Really, quite a character he was. And my mother, she was the exact opposite. She was very quiet. She was a rather short, plump woman. She was quite plump. And such a big smile on her face. Everyone loved and respected my mother. The neighbours round about, if they had any problems, she'd been very well educated too, my mother. Quite a lot of the neighbours used to come in when they had problems to see her and ask her for her advice. And she was the most wonderful cook I've ever come across. Of course, she'd had to cook when she was young, right from when she'd gone to school. She had to help in the kitchens of Bolton Hall, the family boarding house, when she lived with her father and mother. She had to help in the kitchens, and then as she grew older into her teens, she was in charge of the kitchens, apparently. She used to make some wonderful meals. I used to love. Of course, money was short in those days, as I've mentioned earlier, and people had to make do and do the best they could with what they could get. Now, she used to send me to the Dibs, the grocers, to get a ham shank. And she had a big iron pot. She used to put this ham shank in to make pea soup, green pea soup. Now, in those days, there were not many vegetables in tins. So you used to get the dried peas, which you would put in a basin at night time and soak them overnight till the following day to make soup. They were soaking in this bowl of water, and there was a little white cube, I can never remember what it was, whether it was soda or something, which was put in with the peas while they soaked. Then the next morning she would put the peas and cut potato into the pot with the ham shank and make a beautiful pea soup. And she used to put quite a bit of mint in with the soup. I've never tasted soup, either homemade or tinned anywhere, to taste that. Well, for dinner time, that would be the main meal. That's all you had, was soup. You could have a couple of plates of nice thick pea soup. Oh, it was beautiful. And another thing she used to make quite often for us, which was, I suppose, because of the cheapness, but they certainly didn't half fill the stomach, that was to make two rounds of bread and put a bit slight coating of butter in and a good amount of jam and make like a jam sandwich. Then she would mix a batter and dip the whole round into the batter and then put them into a big pan of boiling fat, just like making chips. and this batter would swell up in the sandwich. And then when they were nice golden browned, they were put on your plate, and that was your tea. Quite often we had that. But I used to enjoy them, and one round of this was enough to fill any stomach. And then, of course, we used to, in the summertime, buy herrings when they were plentiful and cheap. And they used to put them in a crock, a stone crock, with salt, and put them down. And eat them. We used to eat them in the winter, salt herrings and potatoes. That was a real Manx dish, that. Salt herring and taters, as they used to call them. And also, we used to buy dried fish. There was a shop just round the corner from opposite the church, Cretney the grocer's. And they used to have these dried fish hanging outside. Oh, those were the days, and those meals. Everything was made from fresh vegetables and fish. They were far more filling and healthy, I'm sure, than the meals one gets today. She was also very good at sewing, and she had a treadle machine, a Singer treadle machine, which her father had given to her for her 14th birthday. And on the top it had a rounded lid, beautiful polished wood rounded lid. And that, she told me, she'd use as a cradle for all the children we'd had. That was, she'd take it off the machine and I'd put cushions in and lay the babes in, myself included. As I got a little bit bigger, I used to play boats in it. I used to sit in it while she was sewing. I used to get the lid and sit in it and rock it from side to side and pretend it was a boat at sea rocking. And she made a lot of clothes for the family. All the curtains and what have you. And as a small boy, a very small boy, up to the age of 5 or 6, I would think, she always dressed me in sailor suits. Little short pants and a sailor's jersey with a collar with the 3 stripes on the collar. I must have been destined to go to sea from that age. But she was a wonderful woman. Everyone loved her, and a really good mother. And yet, I never, can't understand why she never used to leave the house. I only, in all my lifetime that I knew her, I only remember her leaving the house at the most on half a dozen occasions, and that included times going to the hospital. I remember once going out on a picnic with her, and another time I took her to the cinema. She went to the cinema with me to see a film of Richard Tauber, the famous tenor, in a film called Blossom Time, which was based on the life of Franz Schubert. That was the only time that I ever knew her going to a cinema or a theatre even. And yet, in her young days, she had worked at the Gaiety Theatre in the evenings. She was really loved music. She always had the radio on playing musical programmes. And opposite, almost up, directly opposite where we lived at 31 Hillside Avenue, that was down the bottom end, 31, there was a woman in this house in number 54, Mrs. Cooley. She was a woman who came originally from Longsight in Manchester, and she had married a Manxman named Cooley. Old Ned Cooley, everyone called him. But she wanted one of her daughters, to learn the piano, and she'd bought this piano and had it delivered, second hand, of course, in those days. But she didn't know anything about a piano, and she asked my mother, do you know anything about pianos? And my mother said, well, I played when I was a little girl, and my mother would be in her early, she'd be about 50 at this time. Mrs. Cooley said, would you come over and have a look at it and see what you think? So I went over with her, and Mrs. Cooley was there, and she had three daughters and a son. Well, two of the daughters were there, the girl of my age and the next in line, Betty. She was the one who was wanting to be learn the piano. And we sat there, and my mother lifted the lid, and she sat down, and she played it. And she played for about a half an hour non-stop. And then Mrs. Cooley said, I didn't know you could play the piano like that. And my mother said, well, I've never played one since I was 18. That's the last time I played a piano. Amazing, isn't it? And yet, she played perfect. I was amazed, absolutely amazed. But she was, she was really missed by all of us. And that was my mother. When I used to go to school, or later when I went to work, or out for any reason, she used to always laugh. When I leave the house, I always used to say to her, you'll be here when I come back, won't you, Ma? And she used to say, of course I'll be here. But I never once left the house without saying that. You'll be here when I come back, won't you? And so it was until the time came when I came back and she wasn't there. Now, my eldest sister, Winnie, she was born in 1900, so she was 20 when I was born. And when I came along as a baby, she used to take me out in the pram and push me about everywhere. People used to think I was her son. And she was very good to me when I was a baby. She worked, first of all, at a photographer's shop at the bottom of Victoria Street. A photographer called Stafford Johns. He was very well known in Douglas at that time, one of the main photographers. And she worked there as a receptionist. And then later she went to work at a toy shop. I can't remember which one. But she used to always bring me little gifts home, little cheap toys and that, and sweets and ice cream. She was very good to me when I was a baby. But she was a very serious and pessimistic type of person. I think she'd had to look after all of us, being the eldest at one time or another, and she had a bit of a chip on her shoulder. And eventually, I must have only been about two when she married a chap called Cooley, Harry Cooley. He was chief baker and confectioner on ocean-going liners. During the First World War, he'd served on the Mauritania, the old Mauritania, I think it was. It must have been the old Mauritania. And then he left the Cunard shipping line, he went to the Pacific Steam Navigation Company, and he sailed on their ships, the Oropesa and the Orduna. They used to travel from Liverpool through the Panama Canal and down the west coast of South America to Valparaiso, and used to call in at an island called Juan Fernandez. Now that's the island where the real Robinson Crusoe was shipwrecked. A man, probably you've read stories about it, Alexander Selkirk, he was the man who Robinson Crusoe was based on. So these liners of the Pacific Steam Navigation Company, they used to call there, and passengers used to go ashore and look around. So Harry, Winnie's husband, worked on those liners for years. And then as the 30s came along, he used to go sailing on these ships in the winter months. And then during the summer months, he used to get a job in a baker's shop in Douglas. They used to have quite a few shops in Douglas, one in Strand Street, Quirk the Bakers, and they had a bakehouse in the back of Strand Street, and Harry worked there in the summer times. Eventually, when he worried him and he packed the sea up, he left the sea and used to work at Quirk the Bakers in the summer, and then in the winter time he used to take any work that was going. And it must have been about 1922 when she married, because in 1924 she had her eldest child, her eldest son, who was also called Harry. And that's what brings me to one of the first recollections I ever have of childhood. My father took Winnie's boy, young Harry, when he was a baby, he would just be a matter of months old. It was during the summer months, and she used to bring the baby to our house, and my mother used to look after him while Winnie done a few jobs. So my father took him in the pram and me for a walk down the promenade at Douglas. And we were walking along, and of course the promenade was packed with the holidaymakers at the time, and a man and woman came up and started talking to my father and looked at young Harry in the pram. And then she turned round to me, this woman, and she said, "Oh, I bet you're proud of your little brother." And I said to her, "He's not my brother, I'm his uncle." And that's the first thing that I can remember in life. When my father came home and told the family, Winnie's husband, Harry Hewley, he said to me, "Oh, you are Unc, are you?" And from that day on, until the last time I ever saw him, whenever Harry Hewley was in my company, he used to always call me Unc. Never after. Unc. Well, after that, Winnie had another son, Kenneth. And that was her two children. But she was, as later life went on, she grew to be quite a miserable type of woman. And she had a strange hatred for Catholics for some reason. Heaven knows, we were Church of England. But she had this strange hatred for Catholics, which never left her until the day she died. But she was very good to me when I was a baby. And as you'll learn, she was quite good to me later on too. Now then, my brother, Eric, he was a different type of personality. Life was one big bowl of fun for Eric. He left school at 14 and he went to work to serve an apprenticeship at Collinson's the Bakers, who had a restaurant and cake shop in Strand Street, well, Duke Street, which is just before you come to Strand Street in Douglas. And I'm not sure how he come to work there, whether my father had arranged it for him or something, but he went there to work, to serve his apprenticeship. But he didn't, I don't know whether he didn't like the manager or what, or whether he didn't like the work or not. But when he was 16, he never told me parents. He left and he went and found a job with an oil company. Well, it turned out to be Esso in the finish, but in those days it was known as Pratt's, PRATTS, Pratt's Petroleums, which is in later years turned into, it was an American oil company, and they later changed the name to Esso. So he went to work at Pratt's Petrol and never told my family. Apparently my father was a bit annoyed when he found out, but Eric liked it there, and he stayed there until he retired when he was in charge of the Douglas Depot. Apart from the war years, he stayed in that depot until he retired. And he liked it. He liked the work. The only thing was, in those days, they had big tanks. The Pratt's Petroleum Depot was on the quayside at Douglas, on the South Quay. It's still there today. But in those days, they had great big storage tanks. And apparently, every so often, Eric had to go inside the tanks to clean out, because all petrol and that has dirt in it, which is deposited on the bottom of the tanks. When the tanks are getting empty, they used to drain the tank off, and they had to go inside and clean the tanks. Well, he went bald, not on the top of his head, he lost all his hair, but he had hair around the sides and the back in his early 20s. He went bald, Eric, and he blamed this cleaning the tanks at the petrol. But he never let it bother him at all. He still joked about it. He used to say, well, you know, grass doesn't grow on a busy street. You know, grass will never grow on a busy street. And he had a comb, which he took all the teeth out of. Just the back of the comb was like a thick teeth on either side, and he used to shake his hair as if he had a full head of hair and comb it, a toothless comb. So he made a joke of it. And he was interested in the radios when they first came out, and he made quite a few. He learned to tap dance. He was a good tap dancer. And he could juggle. He used to juggle with cups and saucers, and my mother used to have a heart in her mouth. And he played the banjo and the mandolin. And he was involved with the Boy Scout movement at the time. And he used to go around to various halls, local halls, church halls and that, and give concerts or appear in concerts with other people. To get funds, and he was quite a good football player. He played for one of the local teams called Wanderers. Eventually became secretary of the club until they folded up in the 30s. Well, he married a Catholic woman who turned out to be a marvellous wife for him. She was one of the most unassuming people what you could ever wish to meet. A wonderful woman. Nothing ever worried or upset her, Eileen. I loved her. And so did my parents. But Winnie, of course, with Eileen being a Catholic, Winnie was never made friends with Eileen. And she never went to Eric's wedding because he was marrying Eileen Waters, a Catholic. She was a really good wife for Eric, and everyone loved her too. As I say, nothing would upset her. She had children, and when the children had a birthday party or a Christmas party, and she made a jelly and it wouldn't set, she would say, oh, she'd forget to make it. And by the time the meal time come, it hadn't set. And she'd say, oh, don't worry. And she pour it onto the plate. It all goes down the same way, don't worry. We had many a good laugh with Eileen. Her parents were Irish. She had four sisters and three brothers. And every Christmas, she bought me a great big hardback book called The Big Book for Boys. Each year, for about 5 years, she bought these books for me. Oh yes, I loved Eileen. She was a wonderful woman. And she loved a joke just the same as Eric, so they were well matched. They had three children, three boys. The eldest one was Raymond, he was born while they still lived with us in Hillside Avenue. They couldn't get a house at the time, so they came and lived with us. And then they had one which died as a baby, only lived about 12 months and died. And then they had another boy, Paul. And they were a real happy family. Eileen was a dressmaker by trade. She served an apprenticeship at a big shop in Strand Street in Douglas, T.H. Cowan's. Tossie Cowan's, they used to call it. She served, was a dressmaker there. So she was good at making clothes too. My second sister too, Connie, she was a very happy girl. Always full of fun. When we lived in the flats in James Street, she used to have concerts. She used to get the other children round the, from the other flats to come, and they'd be sitting on the flights of steps, and her and the girl in the house opposite us, Maisie Sweetman, and Doris Klukas from the flat downstairs, they used to dance and perform. They used to charge the other children cigarette cards to come and watch the concert, and as I was just a toddler at the time, I used to have to stand and collect the cigarette cards, ticket collector. But they were quite good, and used to be able to do high kicks, and used to have my brother's gramophone playing the music. Used to love dressing up and doing these concerts. And then she was quite clever at school too, Connie, and at the age of 14, she went to the girls' high school, just like Winnie did. Both my sisters went to the girls' high school, and Eric and I, we didn't go to high school. But Connie went to high school, and then when she left school, she got an apprenticeship as a milliner at a big shop in Duke Street in Douglas, R.C. Kane's, the firm were called. R.C. Kane's, and they had, outside the shop, they had big letters, which I didn't know what they stood for ages. D.C. F.C. S. R.C. Kane's, D.C. F.C. S. And it was a long time before I realised, when Connie told me what it stood for, it meant Defy Competition for Cash Sales. But everybody knew them as DCFCS. And she worked there until she married. She used to make loads of hats. My brother's wife Eileen made dresses and Connie made hats. So they were able to help one another quite a bit. In later years she married a chap named Herbert Moore, a real Manxman with a family go way back in the history of the island, and he was secretary to the local government board. So she married him, and they had two daughters. Eric had all boys, Winnie had boys, and Connie had two daughters. But I remember many happy times with Connie. We still she used to take me on picnics. Get me out of the way from the house, I suppose. And we used to walk from Hillside Avenue. There was a short little pathway down to the bottom of Lazy Hill, where we walked from there to Pole Rose and through Pole Rose and out to by Kew Egg, where the Kew Egg School is, and cross over the road there. There's a bridge there that spans the road that takes the train, and there's all bits of like slime hanging from the underneath the bridge, part of the bridge. And Connie and her friends used to call it the Snotty Bridge. I remember that as a child. Well, we crossed the road there and walked along another path out towards Santon, and there's a great big mound of earth there, which they called, well, they used to tell us when we were kids, it was a giant's grave, massive big hump of ground there. And we used to sit on top of this hump and have our picnic, bottles of lemonade and sandwiches. Oh, happy memories. And other times we used to go from not far from where our house was, Hillside Avenue, just by the Nobles Hospital, the local hospital. It was all open country then, and a path through it, which was called the Gooseneck. We used to walk through the Gooseneck and down, right down a slope on this land till you came to Peel Road, the main road to Peel, which is the town on the western side of the island. And there's a grassy bank there with a stone wall at the bottom. We used to call that the hump. Don't know why. I don't know why, but that's what it was called, the hump. And just outside the stone wall, a few yards long, was a little tiny shop. There was an old woman ran it. They called her Mammy Neen. Mammy Neen. It was her shop. This old sweeties and homemade herb beer and sarsaparilla and what have you. So we'd go there and get a few sweets, a bottle of pop or herb beer, and we used to sit on the hump, watch the traffic go past. When one sits down to think back, how the memories come flooding in. And in those days, I know people say these days that it's just imagination, but the summers were really hot, really long, warm summers with long days. A lot of the children used to go around barefoot. It was so hot. And then in the winter, it was cold. Cold, dry and snappy winters with a bit of snow now and again. The climate seemed different altogether. People think it's just dreaming talking of that. But it is true. Hot, long hot summers and long cold winters with a bit of snow.